Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing Board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
We're back. It's a distraction. I'm Drew. That's Roth. How you doing, Roth?
Oh, pretty good. You know me, Drew. Pretty good.
I was arguing with Barry this morning, Barry Pacheski, our deputy editor, because I couldn't think of what essay to write for the Jamboree for tomorrow. And I was like, what if I just go on a diatribe against the word fine? Because I hate the word fine. I think it's fucking useless. And he's like, well, won't you just say acceptable instead? I was like, yeah, but people say fine. It's annoying. And we agreed that I should not use that word. I should not do that essay. So
that's a productive corrected by Barry before you even start writing.
Well, that's the point. It's like, I was like, I can't think of anything to write. But listen, I really hate when people are like, it's fine. If they see a movie, they're like, it was fine. Like they have nothing to fucking say. Just shut the fuck up. Don't even tell me you saw the movie. But anyway, he was like, no, that's really not good enough to support an entire 1,000-word essay.
He's
I'm
like,
sorry,
it's not
Drew.
A bad idea. I would say that it's fine.
Yeah, he was like, yeah, it's fine, I guess. But anyway. Hey, speaking of things that are more than fine, ooh, it's our special guest, Dom Cosentino of The Score. Hi,
we
Dom.
Love Dom.
Hey, guys. Dom. Great to see you again.
Nice
it is
you.
Great to have you back. You are our requisite NFL knower, a former Deadspin colleague, of course, and our best Italian friend, the best Italian friend that Defector had. So we are so, so happy to
Do
have you on.
Do not tokenize Dom.
I'm not doing that. I wasn't like, hey, Adama. He's like, yeah, I wouldn't do that.
Now you're, that was good tokenizing. Yeah, good work.
Then I would feel bad. And then Dom would, after the podcast, would be like, Drew, that was out of line, Drew. Stop doing that. How you doing, Dom?
I'm fine.
Are you? That was well done.
Thank you.
That was very well executed. Where are you? Are you at home?
I'm at home in Brooklyn, yes. Just getting through the week. My son's in school, and, you know, so far so good with that.
Is it your son's first time back at in-person school since the pandemic?
No, he was back on a hybrid basis in the winter and then went back full-time at the very end, the last month of the previous school year, like in May. So,
okay.
So it's...
Go ahead. What was the hybrid like? Was it like, was he in like an A group and a B group? So he'd go 1 week and then virtual the next or something?
It was an A group and a B group where they just did a rotation of 1 day a week or 2 days a week. And for whatever reason, his group always tended to have a day in school when it would have been his day in school that was a day off. So it seemed like he was in 1 day a week for most of the hybrid session. It was hell.
Yeah, that's my kids. They went. They had e-school. We just had them in nothing but e-school all the way through. But the school district always gave them Wednesdays essentially off. Like the elementary school would go till like 10:30 in the morning. And then for middle school and for high school, it was independent study day. So they would have to do work, but they would not have to go on any Zoom calls. And it was kind of this great innovation. And now they have to go to actual school on Wednesday and like pay attention. And they're like, this fucking blows.
Yeah. I feel like that's going to be a hard one to claw back. Like once you get a kid used to the idea of just like fuck around Wednesdays, like replacing that with like just another rock solid, like 8 hours of sitting in a classroom is not really going to fly, I don't think.
Yeah. When Cam was only doing 1 day a week, he was kind of not cool with it. But then once he got back to full time, it was much better for him because I think he just got to be around his friends and get into a routine again and all of that. So it's been way better for him and us.
The difference is amazing when they, you know, when they're stuck, you know, at home for a year and they can't really see friends. I mean, they can see friends like masked play dates at a playground and shit like that.
Yep.
But it's really not the same as being in the shit 8 hours a day with kids you like and kids you don't like, what teachers you like and teachers you don't like. You know, you're more engaged with the world. And so it brought, at least for our kids, you could tell the difference right away when they went back.
Same here. Like he was also, much happier.
Also, they were fucking exhausted.
Yeah. That too.
Just absolutely fucking exhausted. Hey, would you like to talk some football, Dom? Or do you want to start off by talking about the fact that Ben Simmons is big mad and doesn't want to play for the Sixers anymore?
We could do that. Sure. Yeah. Let's go, Ben Simmons.
All right. Let's talk about basketball first, because Ben Simmons threw the dreaded Woj bomb this week. It was reported that he will not report to Sixers camp, staging a holdout, and won't go. So, both of you, since you are both innate basketball knowers, not unlike a Sherwood Strauss, I would say, like really that knowledgeable. Dom, do you think that he will be in a Sixers uniform by the time the NBA season starts, which is only like a month from now?
I don't, because I think the NBA is kind of the one league where players have that kind of power, I think, to force teams' hands. And if, I don't know what the Sixers can do to entice him to show at this point.
I feel like only good players have the power to do that. And I don't know if Ben Simmons counts because he can't even dunk.
He's really good. He's just also a mess. I mean, like, this is... But it's weird. Like, I think they're going to wind up... It's like they've already had to do this with trading Markelle Fultz, and it's like... Having a guy that, like, clearly could, like, with a super-duper high ceiling who's also incredibly broken from one moment to the next, like, Simmons isn't as messed up as Fultz was, but at the same time, like, he's not, like, whatever it was that they thought they were going to get for him, you know, after the playoffs even, like, you know, after the disastrous showing in the semis, like, I don't know that they're going to get that now. And the only teams I ever see him connected to are teams where I feel like he'd get traded there and then he would just hold out because he doesn't want to live in fucking Minneapolis or Sacramento. And, you know, like that's... I think he kind of put himself in that position. He clearly... I guess he wants to be with the Warriors, but like, what would the... I mean, what the Warriors have to trade is basically like a young big man that the Sixers don't need and like Andrew Wiggins and some picks. Like, if they wind up settling for that, I think that like... people will be mad at Daryl Morey, and he'll probably be pretty mad at himself, but I don't know that they're going to do that much better than that.
Right.
I don't know how they could.
Yeah, they're not going to get Damian Lillard for him, you know?
Right.
I mean, so.
Which they still seem to think that that's somehow going to happen, and, like, I mean, who knows? Like, they presumably, you know, like, I haven't been on any of these phone calls, and Daryl Morey's been on all of them, so maybe he's been getting secret signals there, but, like, once you do, like, the black and white Instagram post where you're like, I'm home and I'm happy. This is my house that I live in the Rose Garden. Like whatever it is that Damian Lillard did, where he was like basically making clear that he's committed to Portland this year. Like, I think that's kind of like legally binding in a way that apparently like a long-term rookie max contract is not. Like, I just think that's an obligation.
It'll be interesting. Actually, to me, it'd be an interesting litmus test if he could force a trade, because then it would, like, I think it's different from James Harden demanding a trade, because James Harden was, you know, is someone who's won an MVP and does not have many problems shooting the basketball. And, you know, the idea that if Ben Simmons could do it with, what was it, 4 years left on his contract, even though he's totally broken offensively, if he could force it, then I would think it really would be a demonstration that NBA teams don't have much leverage over these players. And I'm not saying that as an ominous thing. I'm not going to be like, what about the owners? Will someone think about the owners? Mm. It's just more in line with, okay, even if you are someone who passes up a dunk in a playoff game and can't shoot the fucking ball, you can still figure out a way to leverage your way out of town
if you're also an all-star.
Mm-hmm.
If you're, yeah, I know.
Like, Keith Bogans couldn't do this.
Yeah. Everyone's like, oh, well, he plays great defense, but I don't pay attention to defense, so it doesn't matter.
I'm not trying to tell you how to do your podcast, but it's incredible that you got through the whole bit about, like, this is a players' league now without once lapsing into a Simmons voice. I think it's a sign of maturity on your part.
Players' league?
Yeah, now you good. Get now the again, idea. Yeah,
we can move on to things that we actually know about. Let's talk about it, because we have Dom here to talk about the NFL. So you are here, Dom, to engage in a little bit of NFL fraud watch. I would like to know. So I wanted to break this down either by teams who have started off hot or poor, or quarterbacks who started off hot or poor. Which would you prefer? Would you rather break down quarterbacks or teams who have under or overperformed early in the season?
Let's do quarterbacks.
All right, let's do quarterbacks. Let's start with Zach Wilson then. Zach Wilson of the Jets, who I thought actually was the best quarterback coming out of the draft. And that turned out to be quite illusory, because he had arguably the worst performance that any rookie quarterback has had in many years last week against the Patriots, when he threw four picks, four utterly preventable picks. They were his fault. Mm-hmm. They were very much his fault. Is Zach Wilson salvageable, Dom?
I think so. And okay. Salvageable in the sense that I'm not saying he's going to become a superstar, but I don't think he's as bad as the performance Sunday indicated. Belichick's, you know, made a career of teeing off on rookie quarterbacks, for one. He had two receivers out, Mims and Crowder. The Jets' offensive line isn't what people hoped would be. So it's still way too early, I think, to write him off. I'm not saying he's going to become a superstar, but I don't think he was that bad. As bad as he looked on Sunday.
I didn't think he looked that bad in week one.
Yeah, like, he was running good, for his life that day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just feel like in this case, he's like, there's a Jets factor that weighs so heavily here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know it's too soon to say this, but just seeing like Sam Darnold look competent and decently happy in Carolina,
right,
like, makes me think that the Jets factor was actually like underrated in terms
that's
of
that's one where I'm a little less convinced. I'm not convinced that Sam Darnold will be
well. You've
unnormal.
Already like, you basically adopted him as your large child, and
well
then you
I
had to
yes,
deal
I,
with the disappointment.
Well, then I disowned him though, because Joe Burrow came along and he looked enough like me where I said, that's my new son. And then Joe Burrow failed, too. And then I said, you know what? Tom Brady kind of looks like me. So he's going to be my son from now.
You're like, he's basically your hot twin brother. That you
brother,
have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's say
same age.
Let's say that Zach Wilson continues to struggle and he's benched, Dom. Can you remember an instance of a rookie quarterback who was anointed a starter, got benched, and then recovered from that? Because I feel like that's not, I don't have a good instant, like, off the top of my head, I cannot think of a rookie quarterback who flourished after having a really, really shitty start.
Yeah.
Like, usually you play them through.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you'd have to. And the Jets really don't have a backup with any kind of experience either. So they're, you know, it's not like they have a Ryan Fitzpatrick they can turn to. Not that Jets fans want to hear about Ryan Fitzpatrick, but...
But I want to hear about Ryan Fitzpatrick. This is basically, I just call Dom at home sometimes and ask him to tell me Fitz facts.
It's true. The backup for Zach Wilson is Mike White. It's not even
he's
like...
Never thrown
it's not
a
like
pass in an NFL game.
From the White Lotus guy.
There's not even like a Greg McElroy that can lean,
not right.
lean on.
So I think they've got to ride it out with him, I should say, and just see what happens. But, you know, he's got to learn to just... play within himself more than anything. I think part of his problem is just he's forcing throws downfield when he needs to do more checking down and that kind of thing. And I feel like that's maybe the kind of thing he can be coached up to do, but I can't see them pulling the plug on him just because they don't have a really good option behind him.
I worry, same thing as sort of happened with Darnold, is that like, I don't think they're gonna bench him, but I worry that like a couple of seasons of going, you know, now it would be like 2-15 or whatever, like, I can't imagine that does anything for anybody's development, like beyond the reps and stuff like that. Like, just getting your fucking ass kicked every week and like making mistakes and knowing that people are mad at you and stuff. Like, I think that's part of like why you wouldn't, like, why teams wait to start rookie quarterbacks traditionally, is that like they want to make that transition as easy as possible. Once you start one, you can't, I don't know if this counts under your rubric there, Drew. Does like Alex Smith qualify to you in that regard? Because like they started him for years, and then he lost his job, and then he like got it together once he wasn't there anymore to a certain extent.
Yeah, but he didn't become like amazing. Like, I think his accomplishments as his career accomplishments are a bit overstated. Like, he won that fantastic playoff game against Drew Brees and the Saints that one year. And then he went to Kansas City, and he had, like, a, you know, he had a respectable showing as a starting quarterback until they decided to go with Patrick Mahomes. But I don't count him, because he essentially, you know, while with a single team, he went from promising draft pick to sort of useful journeyman, but all while on the same roster at the same time.
That's now the ceiling for Daniel Jones to me, which is part of why I ask. Like, I feel like he's, like, if he winds up having Alex Smith's career, I'll be happy for him. Because
I'll be shocked if that happens.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same. Like, but also, I mean, it would involve the good parts happening with the team that, like, some team that did not draft him, which I think is also, like, probably going to happen for Daniel Jones no matter what.
Let's go to the other side of that game between the Pats and Jets, Dom, because Mac Jones, I think you could argue statistically he has been the most impressive mm-hmm. of all the rookie quarterbacks so far. That's not saying a ton.
Right.
But should I be, and we have the phrase Mac-pilled, should I be Mac-pilled? Should I believe that Mac Jones is going to be yet another great Patriots quarterback, or can I safely and securely assume that he will be mediocre for the time being?
I think, I don't know that it's hard to, it's kind of hard to tell, because it's the opposite of Wilson, where he's done a lot, like almost too much playing it safe and checking down. And they've kind of constructed an offense to put him in position where he's like the game manager type. So I don't know that we really have a read on what he can do when he's in a situation where it's third and long and he's putting the team on his back and making a big throw. He hasn't really done that yet.
Also, another thing where they don't have anyone behind him, because they released Cam almost to prevent the sort of situation where they would have to bench him for Cam,
right,
strictly to stay competitive and therefore destroy his psyche in the meantime.
Yeah, but they've clearly still got the training wheels on for him in a lot of ways. So, I mean,
I would say, Roth, I wanted to go back and dispute your point. What one is that NFL teams always say they're going to take their time with a rookie quarterback, and then they never do.
I think it's been less that they've done it of late. You know, that, like, I have seen it done, and, like, you know, they did it with, like, Tua and stuff like that. But, like, with Tua now, there's, like, the question of, like, is he actually any good? Like,
he's,
I think,
not.
So. And so that's, like, one way to make sure that you're, like, whatever, not exposed there and protecting your draft pick, is you just make him wear a hat and look handsome on the sidelines while Ryan Fitzpatrick does the hard work.
The other thing is that there's no time, Dom. Like,
yeah.
These guys are on rookie contracts, and those are the most valuable things in the world when the rookie pans out. So they have to be good by their second year. Otherwise, you've wasted your time.
Yeah, you can't have an Aaron Rodgers sit the bench for 3 years before you know, behind Brett Favre, like because that's just not feasible anymore, just the way things go. So, but, you know,
right.
It helps to have you ideally want to have a solid roster around the guy, and that's really hard for the quarterbacks like Trevor Lawrence and Zach Wilson, who are taken at the top of the draft by teams with shitty rosters.
Right. I mean, it's just like that's
it's a long rebuild that, you know.
Yeah.
And the Jets, I think, hoped that they finally, you know, they finally have invested in the offensive line, and it's looked terrible, you know. So I think that adds another layer of Jetsiness to all this for them.
I'm inclined to think they're going to be okay, because I think they got a good coach, and I do think they've, like, at least shown some indication to spend money in a way that, like, normal NFL teams do. Like, belatedly, they're doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
But they seem a long way from there now.
Yeah, their rebuild has been executed better than it had in the past so far, but they still have a long way to go.
Yeah.
Speaking of rebuilds, can we go over to the Jaguars and talk about Trevor Lawrence? Because he was awful last week. He was awful, and then there's even the question of, and I believe it's an open question of whether or not his coach will stick around, even though he's a brand new coach, but he's been fucking horrible. And that roster is somehow worse than it was a year ago, and they went 1-15. So then my question to you is Trevor Lawrence struggling because the Jaguars are just so utterly inept? Or is he also part of the problem? Is there potential here that he's actually not going to be as good as his pedigree would suggest?
I mean, it's a chicken and egg question kind of always with quarterbacks with pedigree like his, because, you know, he obviously needs to have a good support structure in place, a good offensive line, good coaching, good receivers, and he's got none of that. And, you know, there's only so much he can do when you know, so much is placed on his shoulders to make plays. it's strange because, yeah, he could be ruined, but it could also be Troy Aikman. I mean, we think back to what Aikman and the Cowboys went through his rookie year.
More than 15, yeah.
They won one game, you know, and then they drafted well, and we all know what happened after that. So it's so hard to tell just yet because I think it's a chicken and egg question.
Are the expectations for rookie quarterbacks accelerated now in the rookie cap era? Like, is it if a quarterback? Because I was used to, you know, even when Peyton Manning started, I think Peyton Manning went 3-13 in his first season.
Yeah, it's another
which
one.
Which was expected. Like, I felt like the expectation was, okay, you're going to start the rookie, and he's going to suck, and the team's going to suck. The team's going to really, really suck for at least 1 year, and then we can sort of go from there. But I don't even know if that, you know, I just said 2 years, but I don't even know if 2 years is correct anymore. Like, I think you got to show something in the first year, or am I wrong?
I think you've got to show, you know, I think Peyton Manning threw a ton of interceptions as a rookie, but he also threw, like, close to, you know, 25 or 30 touchdowns. So I think
he did.
Showing that ability to, like I said, make play, like maybe there's the occasional third and long where he makes a hero ball play. That sort of is something you can hang your hat on for the future. So that's the kind of stuff I think the Jaguars need to see from Lawrence this year, because I don't think they're going to win many games, and I think he's going to take his knocks and throw a bunch of picks.
It's also, I'm pretty sure I got this right, but Patrick Mahomes and Lamar Jackson both won MVPs in their second years respectively. And that almost skews the expectations for every other quarterback that you draft.
Yes, and well, and they also were on drafted into to stable teams, stable franchises. You know, the Chiefs made the playoffs, sitting Mahomes his rookie year until the week 17 or whatever it was, and the Ravens have been a pretty stable, solid team for 25 years. So I think that skews it. But I think the other part of it is that the draft industrial complex just offers, you know, it exists to provide hope for fans. So I think then the expectations for a lot of these quarterbacks that are taken at the top of the draft are a little overblown, because a lot of them don't pan out. But I think there's an expectation that they are going to save the franchise every time they're picked.
Yeah, it's funny.
It's nicer to think about than whatever else you might be thinking about as a Jags or Jets fan.
Right.
But yeah, like I have no idea what Jets fans actually expect. Like, I don't know that they go to games thinking that the team is going to win, right? Like,
I think there was some enthusiasm before the game on Sunday, but I think the reason the booze came raining down by the third quarter is because they're sick of this shit. It's been this is their fourth rebuild in 10 years, you know, and how many quarterbacks? You know, they just drafted a guy third overall 3 years ago, and he's winning games for another team.
And they just basically they dumped him like because they basically couldn't afford to keep him anymore. Yeah, it's pretty grim.
Let me ask you about someone who I think we know is a very good quarterback, and that's Kyler Murray. And I just watched him play out of his fucking mind against the Vikings to beat the Vikings. He had two big mistakes, but really he had a star turn, as he has for, you know, over the past year or so. And I'm wondering if this is the year where he becomes one of those quarterbacks that just automatically wins 11 or 12 games a year, regardless of what happens to be around him. Even if his coach, I think, is a touch underwhelming, is he that kind of quarterback already, Dom?
I think he can be, yeah. Because part of the reason the Cardinals faded down the stretch last year, he had a bit of a shoulder injury. He wasn't able to do a lot of the things he does. But there's a real feast or famine quality with him, just because he's capable of throwing a couple of bad picks like he did on Sunday, but also just, you know, making plays out of structure when he's forced from the pocket and delivering like he did on those two pirouette touchdowns he did the other day. If he's healthy, I think he can do a lot of that and win a lot of games.
He's also now the guy, if you blitz him, you're just asking to get your shit ruined.
Exactly.
Cannot.
A scientific metric, but I think also the fact that he does as much cool shit as he does means that you're probably right in your assessment, Drew, that he's going to win 11 games every year. That, like, there aren't that many guys that can do that many cool things and aren't good.
Yeah,
and that's not, like, grounded in anything other than, like, my amateur vibological understanding of watching, like, whatever the other national game is on CBS every Sunday. But, like, yeah, like, if he can do the shit that he does in highlights, then, like, I don't know where the ceiling is, but it's high.
No, it's true, because, like, once you see players who can do like make those cool plays. Like, there's never been a Daniel Jones play where you're like, oh, that was so fucking cool. If he can do that, he can do anything. Like, that's actually a fairly decent metric, not to go all Simmons on you about
it. That's the magic of, like, the Daniel Jones experience, is that even when he does things that are cool, like when he has, like, a 70-yard run, like, he ends it falling down as if he got shoved out of a car. Like, it's just, like, his special element.
Let's take a break and come back and open up the fun bag and all that stuff.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing Board or...
Miro. Our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Hey, we're back. We're back for the second part of the podcast. Before we get into the fun bag, I did want to offer an old man take. You guys ready for an old man take?
Yeah.
Who's excited for old man takes? All right. So, Packers running back Aaron Jones scored 4 touchdowns the other
night.
That's
too many.
Yeah. No. So
is that the old
and he
man take?
He did a Lambeau leap and he lost his necklace, which contained his dead father's ashes in it. In the stands, and he found them the next day. But also, there was another player on the Mets, I believe. Javi Baez slid into home, lost an earring, like a really valuable earring, and then they had to, like Sandy Alderson, like the GM, like had to come, like, they had to go look, like a huge team effort after they won the game to go look around for, like, the jewelry and stuff like that. And I am not against players wearing jewelry and other shit on the field. That's totally fine. But, like, if you lose that shit, that's on you. Like, you have to find it. You should have to find it yourself. Like, I'm not gonna help you. If you went out there with that, like, if you went out and played with your fucking wallet and you lost your wallet, I'd say that's on you. That's your problem. So I don't have a ton of sympathy if you lose some valuable shit if you brought out into the field. You just leave it in your locker. Is that, how old man is that take, Dom?
As someone who once lost a wedding ring on the beach in Maine for being dumb enough to bring it to Maine, I have to sympathize with the players on this one, Drew. I think you're incorrect.
But it's a wedding ring. That's different.
You lost it. Were you planning on, like, giving it to your fiance in Maine on the beach and then you
We were already married and my dumbass go into the water, just put it in the chair and forgot I had done that.
Oh, man.
Oh, wait. Why didn't you just keep wearing it?
I didn't want to lose it in the water.
But does it slip off? It should be...
When it wet, yeah, it could. Or I'm afraid... I was afraid it would.
I think we need to resize your ring, Dom. I think it's too loose. No, I
just
like...
This is the part of the podcast everyone loves where we do finger measurements.
That's true. No, I wear my wedding ring all the time, even in water. It doesn't come off. Now, I have, you know, I eat a lot of sodium, so my fingers swell nicely around the ring... To give it a nice cushion,
yeah,
so it doesn't come off.
Drew's hands are like ballpark Franks. It's like a
yes,
5-pack.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Got a little chubby little Frankfurter fingers to make sure the ring stays on.
I think it's more fear that I have, just being in the water, that I'm going to step out and it's not going to be on my hand anymore than anything.
When I got married to my wife and we went on our honeymoon, we went to a resort and I got on a jet ski. And I came back with the jet ski, and I took off my wedding ring, and I put it in my pocket. And I was like, honey, look what happened. And I held up my bare hand. She was like, oh. And I was like, I gotcha. And I pulled her hand. She's like, you piece of shit. You total
like, and you're married to me for the rest of your life now. That's the law.
Yeah, I was like, oh, shit, I fucked up. I'm going to be unmarried in record time. There'll be an annulment.
The heartbreak of learning that you've married a prankster.
I remembered when I was a kid, I remembered LT wearing the lightning bolt. earring.
Yeah.
Like the LT earring. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. But I don't think the LT earring, like, I don't think that cost him too much. I would be concerned if you're wearing something that cost you like $50,000 and you lose it. That's all.
I mean, I feel bad for Aaron Jones. I honestly think that this is like a pretty, like, as old guy takes go, like, you didn't go full, like, Orange County Register sports columnist who only writes in one sentence paragraphs with it. You were like, it was more like you're like, you have to be responsible for your stuff. You weren't like, this is not like a fashion show. It's a football game. Like, that would have been the real old man take.
No, no, the aesthetics of it, I'm totally fine with. It's more just like, I don't want you to lose your stuff. And if you lose your stuff, that should be on you. But already I sense the podcast thing where it's like, the other people on the podcast are sort of humoring the shitty old take and like being like, okay, I guess. But why don't we move on so that we don't have to listen to Drew talk about jewelry on athletes as if that isn't problematic entirely. Do you guys want to play dead or canceled?
Yeah, let's get to something less problematic, like asking Dom who's canceled.
Well, that's too bad because I forgot to think of a subject for dead or canceled. So we have to remember a guy of the week. Would you like to remember a guy, Dom?
Sure, yeah.
All right, your guy of the week to remember, Greg Jones. Do you remember former Jacksonville running back Greg Jones?
Oh.
Wow.
I sort of remember Greg Jones.
Yeah, vaguely.
He's
all
not
right.
The Jags running back I remember when I remember Jags running backs.
Well, I mean, you can remember a big name like Fred Taylor or something.
Yeah,
or
Maurice
like
Jones-Drew.
Yeah.
I mean, those are like good backs. Like, but Greg Jones was the sort of guy where he'd get like 120 yards like twice a year. And when he did, you're like, oh, this guy's going to be a fucking badass for the rest of the year. And then they'd never use him again. So
I feel like
Greg Jones
is a tough name for a running back in general. Like, Aaron Jones is working on breaking that curse right now, but then you got your Gregs, you got your Ronald the Second. Like, it's just not like a. I haven't had great. You know, Kevin Jones like got hurt. It's not a name that I trust if in a fantasy football scenario. I want to, you know, give me a Tomlinson. That's a great.
Yeah, but like Aaron Jones is a really good running back.
He is really good.
And he's being used properly, which is like,
I was going to say, that's the part of it that was always like, I'm sure that it must make Mike McCarthy mad to know that he's touching the ball like a lot during the games. Like now that he's not in charge to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Yeah, he's fuming. But the good thing is that Mike McCarthy is now paired with an over-the-hill back who he's entitled to not use all that much.
Hey, McCarthy was doing some good McCarthy shit last week, too. Like, there was really, like, he loves to blame people, circumstances, things, weather formations in a way that, like, I think I'd forgotten because he was, like, so much of the end game in Green Bay was him getting yelled at for, like, decisions he made. And I forgot that a lot of it is like, oh, my visor was giving me a rash and I forgot that you could call passes or whatever. Like, it's just a different energy.
I'm waiting for him to get to the point where he gets testy at when his decision making is questioned, because that's the end stage Mike McCarthy that we all know and love, where he's like, "Well, I'd like to see you try and not sell for a 56-yard field goal." All right, this game is complicated, Mister. Do you guys want to open up the fun bag?
Sure.
Sure.
All right, we're going to try to... We've already broken the record for awkward silences on this episode of the podcast. And we're going to see if we can make that record insurmountable. This is from Matthew Dom. He writes in, "Is there any more damning evidence that Tom Brady is the world's most crashing bore than the fact that his new satellite radio show is named Let's Go was taken or something?"
Roth and I were just talking about how Brady actually has begun to show some personality in the last year and become a bit more relatable, maybe. But
it's almost like Bruce Arians has rubbed off on him or something.
Yeah, being away from Belichick, you know.
Brady starts wearing little hats like Bruce Arians. I think that's a lesson that he could take from him. Become a Kangol guy.
He is like Belichick, where he'll say nothing useful until you ask him some very specific niche question about the game itself. And then all of a sudden, he opens up like a flower, and you get 2,000 words of just brilliant eloquence. But I have already on the record of saying Let's Go is annoying, and I'm very, very sick of it although my sons use it, and it's okay because they're kids. Like, they can say stupid shit.
Kids use it all the time. It's a gamer thing, right? Like, while we're doing old man takes, like, where did this come from? Because we see it on American Ninja Warrior a lot, and it's like all the teens do it constantly. And I feel like it's become like a joke in the household. Like, Kate and I each get one annoying let's go per day to, like, bother the other, and we try to time it for maximum impact. But it just seems like it's a thing that is now, I guess, obviously, like, people who are older than me, like Tom Brady, are also saying it.
Isn't let's go, like, just common, hasn't it been common vernacular our entire lives? It's just weird that it got hashtagged and, like, presented as, like, something.
No, it's not like, let's go Mets. It's like, after you do something, you say, let's go.
Yeah, that's true.
To celebrate
it. It's not beforehand. Yeah.
Yes.
Or let's fucking go, if you really want to put emphasis on the syllable.
Mm. Dom's wisely staying out of this one.
Another shot. Fantastic. Hey, here's a good one. Dom, Mike writes in, how has AI not made its way into NFL play design? I'm no computer scientist, but it seems like it would be the perfect opportunity to create plays based off actual data instead of what some meathead coach thinks might happen. Or are there just too many variables to account for it in football? Why is there not, well, first of all, is there any AI play design in football right now? Could there be AI play design and AI play calling?
I think there could be, yeah. Now that they have the player tracking data to work with, and there's so many possibilities that presents, I think they could do it, yeah.
Could they, but would they?
Yeah, I think you've got, like, I can see a coach like John Harbaugh or Kyle Shanahan doing it. You know, I don't know that Mike McCarthy would, but yeah.
Definitely not Mike McCarthy.
I think you have, like, some younger forward-thinking coaches that would certainly be open to anything like that, for sure.
Is it possible that they're... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Roth.
No, I was going to do sort of a meta commentary on how bad people are going to be if it ever happens. So ask your actual question about the thing itself.
No, I think that would be the same thing, where if a team was ever like, we're not going to have a designated play caller, we're actually going to run it through an algorithm, and we're going to call plays that way, I think people would be mad. And
they'd
be
insanely mad.
They'd be really mad. It might totally work, but I think they'd be mad. And also, I wonder if coaches would be willing to grant that agency to a machine instead of being able to take credit for their own masterful play designs.
Yeah, they may not. They might maintain veto power over the machine, but I think they would allow perhaps the machines to provide input, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Why haven't they done it yet? Don't they have the power to do it now?
They may be doing it now. You know, in terms of just, it may not be for play design, but, you know, when they consider things like win probability or, you know, like on a fourth down call, that kind of thing, I think a lot of that is already going on.
Yeah, that could be Detroit Lions information, and we don't know it.
No, I know that, and Harbaugh has said he's used that in the past. But I'm talking about, like, exact play design. Like, do you think there is a team out there now that does have a little computer that says, run a draw, like, run, like, third and six or something like that?
I don't know if we're there yet.
I mean, just to see the way that it's used in baseball, I don't think that they're going to get there in the NFL.
So many variables involved.
Not at that granular level. Yeah, because there's so many variables. And then also because, like, the way that, like, that sort of data gets used in baseball is, like, basically, like, a group of people in the front office creates sort of like a dossier for the manager to look at, and then the manager either does or doesn't do the stuff that's recommended in it. But it's not like for like pitch sequencing or like stuff like that. The idea of, like, you know, and assume here that Marvin is an acronym for something, that like your robot Marvin that calls all your plays, like, it's not going to be like giving you, like, I don't think that that's like feasible, or like that any coach would want to go along with that if it was just sort of like instantly assessing the algorithmic probability of like a draw play working on a second and six or whatever. Like, I'd hope that wouldn't be what it would be. I just, to me, like, I wonder to what extent Dom would know more about this than me, but like, I can just see, like, culturally there being a great deal of resistance to this just on principle in a lot of NFL front offices. Like, as bad as the discourse is in baseball about, like, nerds ruining the game or whatever, where there is, like, I think some element in which, like, nerds have made baseball worse, like, mostly through, like, payroll shit. like, I don't think that a lot of NFL front offices would be willing to take, like, even a big first step in terms of, like they'll take the information, but they're not going right. to, like, necessarily do what it says.
Yeah, I think it would be more of a data harvesting kind of thing than, right. you know, where you're going to let a machine actually design and then call a play without any input from a coach. That might be a step too far.
Yeah, I think also, Roth, I think, you know, in terms of like the Astros and how the Astros operate, it's less about, oh, those nerds, than it is about teams figuring out the most efficient and bloodless way to do business.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And that goes beyond just, oh, they're dorks with numbers and math. Like, it's more in, it's taking out any human element from the game, and not just from the game, but more importantly, from like how you do day-to-day business with people, the people that you yeah. work with. And that's where it gets creepy and gross.
The Astros, it's weird too, because it works as a player development tool right up until it stops doing it. That, like, the thing that they do, I mean, they're not the only team that does it, but like the real difference maker for them during the McKinsey years was that they really understood their own farm system spectacular and other farm systems really well. They had video cameras, they had TrackMan and all that shit in all their minor league ballparks. So they knew more about more players than any other team did. And that's useful in some ways, like, because they're not trying to win games in the minors necessarily. They're trying to like develop talent.
Right.
And that's not like a problem in the NFL. You know, there's like 20 guys on a practice squad, and like some of them are, you know, like just no-hopers, and some of them are like Le'Veon Bell at this stage in his career or whatever. But they're not, those guys aren't being like developed. It seems like so much of that, like in the NFL especially, is like, I don't actually know much about NFL player development, but I sense that a lot of it happens in college.
Yeah.
It depends on the position, I think. Like quarterback, I think there's a lot of development that needs to be done at the professional level. I think offensive line too. Depending upon, a lot of it also depends on which college, what kind of college system you come from. You know, if you come from a spread offense in college and you're going to a zone blocking scheme that's based off of play action, like the way, you know, Minnesota or Tennessee does it, then it's a different system for you, and you have to learn a lot of different shit. So it can vary, but I do think that there is a lot of player development that has to be done in the NFL. And I think there are definitely franchises that are better at it than others.
Yeah. And, you know, Alabama's a program. They produce a lot of NFL players now for the reason Drew just stated, that I think they do a good job of developing them to play at that next level. But yeah, a lot of it happens once they get to the league. And I think the player tracking data and a lot of that stuff is influencing how teams get, you know, that's kind of the new frontier here, is how they can develop these players once they have them, because of all the data they now have.
I also wonder if there's someone outside the NFL who's already working feverishly to create AI play design and play calling systems so they can sell it for a mint, obviously. But, like, I just feel like that, you know, there's going to be someone who's like, oh, well, this, you know, this shifts the paradigm of coaching entirely and presents it at, I don't know, fucking Show West or something like that to a bunch of people. Like, I feel like someone is going to attempt to incept it into the game, and there'll be a real moment where the NFL either welcomes it or is like, no, bridge too far for us.
Yeah, I mean, the league has become much more welcoming to data-driven decision making in recent years, and it's actually happened pretty quickly. So yeah, I don't know that there's. It's tough to foresee something like that, but there's a lot happening right now, and it's happened. Yeah, the pace has been very quick.
Olaf, right?
See how it happened in baseball too. I mean, it's just a normal process of co-optation. Like, the people that are outside doing this work were like, I mean, they just got hired by teams. Like, they started out doing it for yucks on like blogs and stuff like that, and then just like, there's a ton of those like sabermetric blogs where like guys, you know, they developed some new way of like quantifying something or whatever. And like their last post was in like 2014 yeah. and they got hired by the fucking Tigers. And like, that's, you know, good for them, I guess. But it is a different sort of thing.
So they all, it all follows the same pattern where there's resistance against it until somebody shows that it works. And then that's when everyone's like, oh, well now we want to do that. But it's only once someone has proven that they can do it. And so it has to slip through that one crack and then it can work.
That's why every team is like, I want a Zach Taylor type to coach. Yep. We have to find a Zach Taylor.
I'm writing story. Olaf. I'm sorry. I'm writing
no,
story.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'm writing a story this week about fourth down, teams being aggressive on fourth down the way the Ravens were the other night. And that's kind of become a thing coaches are doing more and more of because they're seeing the benefit of going for it on fourth down.
Yeah, you get more shit from the public now for not going for it on fourth than
which
you do.
Which did not happen just a few years ago. You know?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, even 5 years ago, like, it was the sort of thing where, like, and it's weird because it's like the sort of thing where, like, when Dan Campbell does it, you're just like, because he's Dan fucking Campbell, man. He's like, like, all gas, no brakes, like, full send 24/7. But it's also like, it is the smart thing to do. Like, just because it's Dan Campbell doing it doesn't mean it's not, like, enlightened or whatever.
Well, Collinsworth and Michaels were kind of losing their mind over what the Ravens did at the end of the game the other night, but it was the smart play. It wasn't just some gutsy thing that they decided to do. It was the right move, you know, for a million different reasons, including the best way to win this game is to keep Patrick Mahomes off the field, and you've got a very good chance of making this first down if you go for it rather than play
because you have Lamar Jackson.
At some point, all the academic, like, arguments with it sort of fall apart because it's like, at that point, you're just advocating for punting, and, like, no one really wants to do that. Like, everybody knows what that means.
Well, the other thing is that, and this is, it's broken down now. Someone mentioned it on Twitter, but, like, the standard thing now is to say, I'm glad they went for it on fourth down, but I don't agree with that play call. And I do that all the time with my team because, like, I saw it. It was the Lions the other night. They had fourth and one. And of course they lined up Jared Goff in the fucking gun, which drove me nuts. Like, I hate it when, just on principle, if you're a yard away from a first down and you voluntarily snap the ball back so you're 6 yards away from a first down and that's how you start your play, I think that's very bad and I don't like it. Especially if there's a fucking empty backfield, which my team has done in the past.
The Steelers do a lot of that too. And you sound exactly like me watching them do it. So,
drives me nuts. Olaf writes in. Olaf finally gets his letter in. I am a tall person who walks pretty fast. What is the etiquette for when you are behind a slow person or slow people and you want to walk around them? I just book around them. I'll walk into the fucking street to pass them, Dom.
Yeah, I do that too. I kind of wait for my moment, you know, because this happens a lot in New York, but, you know, you wait for your moment when there's a space. I feel like a young Le'Veon Bell looking to find the hole, you know,
I'm
waiting
so
patiently.
Happy that you're saying this. Like, this is so liberating. I have the same thought, and I'm always embarrassed by it.
Yes, yes.
But it's the same way, especially because I'm fucking late for everything. So half the time I'm going to the train, it's like I'm a punt returner, and everybody is trying to, like, obstruct me from catching the queue and arriving only 7 minutes late as opposed to, like, 17.
No, I have this feeling like, you know, if I make the move, am I going to bump this person? And you know, there's this nervousness of waiting to make that decision. But as soon as I find an opening, I'm bursting through that hole.
I
also have experienced the opposite thing because I have children and children can be a little bit slower. And you can feel someone coming.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you feel the heat coming on you and you're about to get tailgated and you're like... And, like, I have had my wife be like, we have to move out of the way for these people. And, like, I'll do it now. But in the beginning, I was like, I'm not moving for nobody. They can fucking wait. But, like, the people
like,
who don't
hell at walking. If they can like it or they can lump it.
But the people who have no pocket awareness of the fact that I'm behind you and I need to get around you and you can't sense me breathing down your fucking neck so you can get out of the way.
The worst are the people who seem to sway. Just as you're about to make the move, they kind of sway in front of you somehow. Like, they, you know what I mean? Like, they just cut you off. And I really hate that.
Like, they give you no... I get frustrated with people who don't... I mean, they're doing that because they don't know that I exist. Like, they don't... Like, they're just, like, on their phone or they're having a conversation. But, yeah, those are the people that I'm maddest at over the course of an average day. It's just, like... some lady going home from work, like, just having a normal day, who keeps, like, veering in front of me as I'm attempting to, whatever, make
my
move.
Stop drifting into my lane, please.
Yeah, because I always think they're doing it on purpose. Like,
yes,
I know they're
right,
not,
right,
but
right.
I'm always like, oh, they're trying to fuck me by closing up the space so I can't get past them. That piece of shit. And they're on their phone. Ah! I get so mad when they're on their phone. Do you want to do one more question, or should we bail?
Yeah.
Ooh, all right. Ben writes in, when you moved to the D.C. area, he's talking about me, how did you decide which local TV news you watched? Growing up in the D.C. area, our family watched Channel 9 with Gordon Peterson because of the weather person. Might you ask some of your comrades at Defector why they chose the local news stations they watch? Okay, so this assumes that we watch local news, which we probably don't. But I did for a while when I lived in New York. Dom, do you watch your local news? How did you choose which New York station you watch for local news?
I don't so much anymore, but when I first moved here and before we had a child, we would have New York 1 on in the morning. And, there's something about Pat Kiernan and that group on New York 1. And I think they cover the neighborhoods fairly well, so it was just that's sort of why we chose that one.
Everybody loves Pat Kiernan.
That's like also like real news you can use, which is good. Like so much of the local news here, and I think it's probably true everywhere. Like again, I've only ever seen it like at the house I grew up in and at my in-laws' places. Is that like it's just like who got murdered near you,
right?
Every day, and like that's the entirety. And then weather and sports.
In a house, this and house like, caught on fire. You know that kind of thing. You know,
it's also.
Like, I think like New York One can actually like help you with your commute. Like you're going to get like information that might actually have some utility to you.
Yeah, because a lot of times it'll be like, what drugs should your children be afraid of this week? We'll find out.
Yeah, there's none of that sensationalistic nonsense on New York One, and I think they cover the neighborhoods pretty well. Roger Clark's very entertaining. So we've just watched less of it now that we have a kid, but that's what we watched when I came.
Well, my wife and I lived in New York, and we didn't have kids. We watched Channel 4 News with Chuck Scarborough and Sue Simmons, and we were like, oh, they're our friends. And then we moved
simply iconic.
Yeah, and then we moved to D.C., and we had Jim Vance, and I think he's still there, and like he was always like, hey, here's what happened today on news. He was like very smooth and elegant. We liked Jim Vance a lot. But you get like, you have that thing where you get older and you get like attached to the local news person. Like, oh, they're my friend in town. They know
this
all
this is the
about
man who tells me who got murdered. It's my buddy, Chuck. One thing that always stuck with me, about, like of all like McQuaid's tales of Philadelphia, is his assertion that the most famous people in Philadelphia are the newscasters.
This is true.
And I think it seems kind of unique. Like, Dom, you probably could speak to that a little bit. But
yeah,
like,
no. When I lived down
is
there.
Is it really, like, different?
Yeah,
than
like the
here?
Gossip like, pages, you know, in the Daily News and the Inquirer, the stuff they tended to get were the restaurateurs, and it was about the restaurateurs and the TV news anchors, because they were like the famous people around town. You know.
I think in the heartland, it's true, too. Like, I think whoever is the anchor in Indianapolis or something, Bob Hansen Jansen or whatever the fuck, like, I'm sure that they are big, big fucking deals in small-town America.
Yeah, there's a great bit in that Sam Anderson book about Oklahoma City boomtown, which I liked very much, where he talks about a guy who's, like, the sort of, like, the alpha weatherman of that. And it's, like, so much of that job in Oklahoma is, like, being in like, it's not like the haircuts that do it here where you're just sort of like, it's going to be humid again. Sorry, everyone. Like in Oklahoma, it's like you're in a fucking command center giving people life or death information about like tornadoes.
Yes,
and that's
sir.
Like
it's rather
months
important.
Out of the year you're doing that. And so like this guy had the fucking weight of the world on his shoulders. Like it's a great little like profile. Like there's, you know, a lot of different characters sort of in the book. But it was like, it never occurred to me that it would be hard to be a TV news person. Like, I always just, because here it's like, I feel like Sue Simmons shows up like 3 minutes before that shit starts and just like sits down and reads it and then it's like, see ya. And like just goes.
Yeah.
He just gave Zoom the finger. So I just
I
want
did,
that.
I did. Well, Sue Simmons also is like, I mean, another one of those people that like, yeah, a trusted voice, but also someone who's been like caught on video yelling at people a lot.
Oh, has she?
Brian Curtis wrote that story about Dale Hansen down in Dallas, that he would do the 6 o'clock news, then go to the bar. And then there was one night when he was having such a good time at the bar, he realized the broadcast began, but he raced back and was back in his chair, did his whole sports routine like nothing had happened, but he'd been drinking beer for like 5 hours.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds,
he did that regularly.
Perfectly Dale Hansen and perfectly. Yeah. He seems like the, I don't know that they're making him like that anymore, which is weird. It's like, I've only seen like the same clips that everyone else has. And I read, like my buddy Mike Colucci wrote a little profile of him on his last day. And he seems like a very likable and like actually like a fairly insightful guy. Like, I think he was just like really dedicated to like hanging out with the boys and being on TV. And he's like aware that he like fucked some stuff up in his life as a result. Like, there's more thoughtfulness there than you'd think.
Right.
But also just, like, I don't know. Like, I don't think that there are a lot of guys that would drink beer for 5 hours and then go back on TV. For better or worse. Like, I feel like we might be more entertained if there were.
I used to definitely know, like, local sports guys like Warner Wolf in New York and shit like that. I could not name any of them in D.C., Dom.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a different breed now, you know. I just think that the sports broadcasts on local news are pretty pointless now anyway, just in today's age.
It's just so far behind.
You're not tuning in, right. You're not tuning in to get the National League scores at 11:30, you know.
Right, and like when they're happening and stuff like that. The idea would just be and like, why the Mets are losing right now. Like,
and why get your news from those people when you can listen to a podcast? I mean, really.
Yeah. If it's something as professional and polished as the Distraction Podcast on Stitcher and Stitcher Premium, come on.
Did you say Stitcher Premium? Because Brandon Nix is our producer and engineer. Daisy Rosario is our executive producer. Our theme song is by Kirk Hamilton. And you can listen to ad-free episodes of The Distraction only on Stitcher Premium.
What's that promo code?
And thanks to us, you can get a free month of Stitcher Premium right now. Just go to StitcherPremium.com and use the promo code DISTRACT. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe wherever it is that you listen. And go subscribe to defector.com too while you're at it. And read Dom over at the score. And go to the Defector store for merch too. The Defector store, where America goes for Defector merchandise. That is it for this week. Dom, thank you so much for enduring us. You were very, very patient and very gracious. And I cannot thank you enough.
I love coming on this and I love talking to you all. And I'm very proud of everything you've all done at Defector. So keep it up. I miss you all.
It is always a treat to have you. Thanks, dude.
Yeah, we'll see you next week. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing Board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.